Hey, Southern Last Podcast fans, we're going to be in Atlanta playing at the Earl on Saturday, June 18th. Go to badearl.com to get your tickets. It's $18 in advance, $20 on the day of the show. This is definitely going to sell out, so be sure to go and get your tickets right now. That is Last Podcast on the Left, live at the Earl in Atlanta. Now, on with the show.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the Last Podcast
on the Left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Okay, there we go. I'm back in
Nike
business.
Shoes.
I apologize.
Nike shoes are the best shoes.
I did like our color conversation, though. Green is my favorite color because I think it's ugly.
Which is very sad. And you like brown, Marcus, because you like dirt.
Dirt!
That's what you like. You like anything mottled, like the underneath of a boot. All right, my favorite color as a boy was purple because of Whoopi Goldberg.
From what?
I want to say The Color Purple.
Oh, yeah.
And then, isn't that movie about rape?
You know, it wasn't about rape. You know what I mean? It wasn't like that was, that's not the first word
it's
that pops up.
It's a heavy movie for a child.
When you go through movie? Showtime, it doesn't say in the show description, rape, exclamation point. And then be like, Whoopi Goldberg is part of this wonderful tale of race and family.
All right. So there you go, everyone. A little insight into why we have our favorite colors. All right. We got to continue on with the Hillside Stranglers. We're on to episode 3. Things just get, it never gets good. No, I just have to say, things are always kind of bad.
Their antics never got funny.
No.
And you know what? I watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and you watch that and you're like, those antics are just charming. Right. I love to see them abscond with the ladies and with the bank teller's money. But the Hillside Stranglers are just bastards.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no Sundance Kid to lighten the mood.
But if they were just a little bit more handsome. Like the guy that did, the guy that was the rapist that had the mugshot that came out that they said the world's hottest felon, and then he got released from jail.
He was
and
a
now
burglar.
He's got a modeling contract in Los Angeles, California.
Yeah, he wasn't a burglar, or he wasn't a rapist, he was a burglar.
Burglar's the first step
also,
towards rapist.
Okay, whatever. I
what
have
we
say,
learned?
I am confirmed. Big and tall Kmart model. I did the shoot this Tuesday. I just want to make that clear.
Yes,
okay.
Congratulations,
Ben.
We're all very proud of you.
Was it you, like, struggling against a boa constrictor, or are you, like, struggling against two, like, growing mangrove trees, just being like, see the giant face the forest?
It was amazing. All the other models were very in shape, and that morning I finished off my Papa John's pizza.
Yeah.
So I was a different kind of model.
Or right up top, I'd like to make a small correction to the end of the last episode. Now, according to a confidential source of mine, Sean Bianchi is not the real name of Ken Bianchi's son. I won't say it here out of respect for the guy's privacy. I won't tell you his real name.
Adrian Brody.
Oh, wow.
But after checking birth records in California, I discovered that Bianchi's son was actually born 9 days after the murder of Cindy Hudspeth, the last victim of Bianchi and Bono. So that means that Ken was actually present at the birth of his son, not out killing a woman at Angelo's upholstery shop, as we said at the end of the last episode.
Whatever. Wow, he must have been a really good guy then.
Yes, I'm going to say he's Father of the Year.
Father of the Year.
At any rate, on February 17th, 1978, the Hillside Strangler murders ended just as abruptly as they began. The partnership would have almost certainly continued indefinitely, as we know, killers don't stop killing until they're caught, but Ken's recklessness and his increasing love of publicity caused Bono to cut ties with his cousin completely.
Well, after their super rash murder that they did, basically of Bianchi grabbing a woman inside of Bono's upholstery shop and murdering her right there, Bono apparently took a gun out of his office and went,
fuck you! Jennifer, fuck you, Jennifer, and I hate your name. I hate everything about you, alright?
I'm going to say that's sort of a Charles Ng meets Deputy Dewey from Scream.
He is. That's how I would describe Bono.
So, Bono was the brains behind the operation. He was the one who kept Ken's enthusiasm, for lack of a better word, in check, making sure he never took too many risks, and the impromptu murder at Bono's upholstery shop told Angelo that Ken was not someone that he could work with anymore.
Well, he was like the brains, kind of like, he reminds me of Iago the Parrot from Aladdin.
Oh,
and that
yes.
And that Beyond donkey was sort of like one of the hyenas from The Lion King.
Bring it back Whoopi Goldberg on that
one. Whoopi Goldberg's got a lot to do with this case, the color purple.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So he's sort of the head coach behind the whole thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's the one that keeps Dennis Rodman and Scottie Pippen from choking each other.
Oh, wow. Hot scene.
God, that's sexy.
Yeah, it was kind of sexy.
Now, even though it might have been a smarter idea to keep Ken close where Bono could keep an eye on him, Angelo disliked Ken so much and wanted him out of his life so much that he convinced Bianchi to leave Los Angeles and join his wife Kelly in Bellingham, Washington, where she had recently moved, wanting to escape the seedy streets of Los Angeles.
Bellingham, Washington does sound like the place where every house comes with its own butler.
Yes.
It sounds like a very wealthy place, which means it's probably extremely poor.
Again. Ma'am, would you like some eggs? They won't let me leave.
It's a town of about like 400,000 in rural Washington.
Oh.
Yeah. In Washington, yeah, we all think Seattle's super hip. Now, Washington and Oregon just full of rednecks after you get out of the cities.
Mountain people.
Yeah, rednecks, white supremacists. Go see Green Room for a good, an actual good representation of what happens out in the wilds of Washington and Oregon.
I thought Kelly moved to Washington because she just didn't know what to do with that tossed salad and those scrambled eggs.
Love Fraser.
And you're coming again. That was the other big move to Seattle. We did this before, but I like getting into the Frasier joke of this episode.
Yes, this is actually true. The dog from Frasier made $100,000 an episode.
The dog itself?
Yes.
How did it fill out its W-2?
No idea.
How did the paw print? So. It was a nightmare for accounting.
Now, as far as we know, Bono never killed again after Kim Bianchi left town, and it is actually very likely that Bono never killed anyone. It seems as if this murder spree with Ken was almost just a lark to Angelo, just another way to explore his sadistic urges without having to take the last step necessary to get away with the kind of no-holds-bar brutality that these two participated in.
Yeah, I mean, now that all the killing is done, what I really decided to get into was something kind of been a passion of mine for a really long time, getting into the saxophone.
Oh, I thought you were going to start building your own battle bot, which would be a very...
You know what? That's a really good idea. I like the wedge ones because they're impossible to knock over.
That's a good point. Whoever made the ladybug one was ridiculous, by the way.
I mean, if you do that sort of brutality, kidnap and torture, you have to kill the victim. Like,
yes.
That's something you have to do.
You
cannot leave a living witness, and Bono couldn't do it. Like, he was not a killer. He was a fucking monster, but I don't think he was a killer.
Kennifer was the killer.
He
just kind of went back to his roots. And also we see the trends in psychopathy, right? Where he was bored by the process after a while.
Yeah, he completely lost interest. But Ken, he turned his life around completely upon reuniting with his wife and son in Bellingham. And for 11 months, Ken held a job at the Coastal Security Agency as a security guard, where his bosses and the customers loved him and made him the most requested member of the crew.
But I have some other information that says that Kenny, during that time, was doing a little bit, dabbling back into shady shit. Mm. He was allowing himself to build back up, which has allowed these murders to happen again, was that he started offering photography like sessions for models. And he said that he wanted to do nude shots of women. And then there was another woman who reported that he asked her if he could be her pimp.
So he was a security guard / fashion photographer?
Yeah, I say fashion photographer.
Fashion photographer?
Because that's what it is. It's because it's F-A-U-X-S-H-I-O-U-N, a fashion.
Yeah. I will say that does make you a serial killer.
Yes.
A fashion photographer?
Being a security guard /
fashion photographer?
Yeah, no, you're a serial killer.
Yes.
But his supposed good behavior would not last long, for on January 11th, 1979, Bianchi would commit a crime that would shock the small town of Bellingham, Washington, and bring the case of the Hillside Stranglers to a close.
And where was Niles during all of this? He would have had something funny and nerdy and kind of gay to say.
Cutting.
Yeah.
He wasn't gay.
Well, he was.
He was. Don't tell me that.
Karen Mandick, a 22-year-old student, knew and had made friends with Kim Bianchi during his time as a security guard at the department store where Karen worked. And as far as she knew, he was friendly, popular and a doting, loving father. He talked about his kid constantly. That's what everyone said about him, is that he was a doting father, that he loved his son.
It's a great cover for a serial killer.
It's an amazing cover for a serial killer. We saw the same thing with BTK. Of course, everyone hated him out on his dog catcher runs. But back home, like, we actually know somebody who knew Dennis Rader. She was friends with one of Dennis Rader's daughters and said that, yeah, he was out and about. He was always the fun guy at the barbecue.
But he was the guy whose job it was to strangle dogs.
Yeah, terrible person.
Yeah, he's the worst, but he had a great cover.
That's why I don't trust any of these helicopter parents you see all around Greenpoint.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Blech.
Now, Ken got a hold of Karen and told her that he'd gotten a job repairing an alarm system at a house outside of town, and he wanted to see if she wanted to help out on the job, she would house it while he took the alarm away to be repaired.
Normal job. Mm-hmm.
Fairly normal job. Yeah, all you gotta do is you just gotta sit there, keep an eye on things.
I mean, anybody could have done it. Anybody else besides this random woman that you met that you constantly tell her what a loving father you are and probably insinuate that you kind of want to take her out on a date. But she kind of laughs it off a little bit thinking he's just a goofy dad. You know, he's just a goofy dad.
Sure. Yeah. Now, in exchange for that, Ken would pay her $200.
Wow.
Almost $400 in today's money. And the only stipulation that Ken had was that Karen was not to tell a single soul where she was going or what she was doing.
Interesting.
Yeah, seems that, kind of like a warning sign.
Seems like a thing where a guy says, don't you fucking tell anybody where you are, what you're doing here. Okay, I'm going to go, I got to get a baba to my son. He's just the cutie patoots.
Yeah.
Karen, just a little bit suspicious, asked if she could bring her friend Diane Wilder along. Ken agreed.
Yeah! Yeah, Diane! Yeah, what she look like? I'm not that it means anything to me, but it's like, what she fucking look like?
Okay, disturbing, Henry, disturbing.
And he told them to meet him outside the house later that night. Around 7 o'clock, Karen and Diane pulled up to the darkened house where Ken came out to meet him. Now, Karen went in with Ken first, where she, as she was walking down the steps to the basement, was strangled from behind by Bianchi. And Ken returned and led Diane inside, where she met the same fate.
You just never want your last moments to be scared walking down a flight of stairs going, Karen, Karen, are you here? Karen? Ugh.
It is a nightmare situation.
I just call the cops. I always go beep boop boop first thing, and then even if Kissel's just asleep next to the refrigerator,
right.
I know that he's safe down in the basement when I go down there.
Always make sure if you're walking in front of somebody that the person behind you has their shoelaces in their shoe.
Yes. Always check their shoes.
Where are the laces?
Scream at their shoes. If you're going with a man alone in a building that you don't know where you're going or what you're doing, and you got to follow him down a bunch of steps down to a basement, just turn around. Like, show me your shoes!
Show me the shoes!
Now, after he killed him, Ken loaded the two bodies back into Karen's car, drove it to a cul-de-sac, wiped the car clean of his fingerprints, and walked back to his truck. But Ken, without the supervision of his mentor, Angelo Bono, left a trail of clues behind that would get him arrested less than 24 hours later.
He learned nothing.
He learned absolutely nothing. Now, first of all, Karen had not kept her promise to not tell anyone where she was going that night. She let her boyfriend know where she was heading and who she was going to meet. Furthermore, Ken had also called up the woman next door to the murder scene and told her to not go anywhere near the house that night, as armed guards were patrolling the scene. And of course, the nosy neighbor noticed Karen's car that night and called police when an APB went out with a description of Karen's green Mercury Bobcat.
I just feel like if I was the boyfriend of this woman, Karen, I would have grown a 5 o'clock shadow, picked up a smoking habit, and immediately become a detective in an Oldsmobile.
Absolutely.
I would have just followed
just
the car.
Just combing the streets.
Yeah.
Where are you going? That's so funny. And hang out by like phone booths.
Yeah. If for some reason it's only raining above you.
Now, the police, working with Ken's boss, who was in a complete and total state of disbelief that Ken could be involved in anything criminal, much less murder. They arrested Ken later that afternoon, and Ken put on such a good show that even the arresting officer was convinced that the real killer had used Ken's name as an alias.
They put together a really interesting case. Moa, his boss at that job, really pieced this together, because when they showed up at Bianchi's house, they asked him, so basically they want to know his whereabouts of where the hell he was. It's like during the time when these women disappeared, and he said he was at a sheriff's recruitment center meeting, some weird police meeting,
sheriff's reserve meeting.
Yes, and so he went, and he was like, so Moa's just like, you know what? A lot of things are not working out with this guy, like, because at this point, it's like he was well loved at the security center, but he was a loudmouth, and he was always talking up shop, and he was like always like he would introduce himself as a rank that did not exist all the time. He called himself captain, and so like all of
captain
the shit,
of the security
yeah.
team.
Yes,
yeah, that's what the guy my bodega calls me. Hey, what's up, captain?
That's strange. I think he thinks you're a police officer.
He might.
So Moa put together these little kernels, being like, I think there's something like fishy about what Kenny's talking about. So he called the sheriff's reserves and asked if Kenny showed up to that meeting, and he didn't. So they were like, well, what are you going to do? And so now they're piecing things together. The cops call Moa and being like, we need to bring him in, but we think he may be like a dangerous guy. If he committed these crimes, he's very, very dangerous. And so Moa faked a call to Kenny and said, hey, you have to go over and check out the security desk that is unmanned. It's on this like remote part of this parking lot. And so Kenny went out there to check it, and a cop was there with his gun out, and they arrested him.
Mm-hmm. And then Kelly was, of course, called in for questioning as well, and having no idea whatsoever of her husband's duplicitous nature, gave police the go-ahead to search their house, a fatal mistake for Ken on Kelly's part. Now, first of all, cops found a cache of expensive telephones, which Ken had stolen from houses, and although he did have other stolen objects, the vast majority was expensive telephones.
Well, I mean, you never know when you gotta make a call. That's good. I mean, I guess so.
Yeah, but you can, of course, yeah, but all you need is one phone.
Yeah. It is.
You don't
eight
backup phones.
Now, I actually do have to say, I can see being in a situation where you are stressed and you say, I'm going to the telephone room. Do not bother me for 30 minutes.
I never interrupt Kenny when he's in the telephone room. None of the phones are connected to any sort of wire.
But yet he's always having conversations with somebody.
But he also had a cabinet full of canned crab meat. Well, that's also true.
Oh,
they said,
man,
they opened up a cabinet and a cop got hit with a fucking pile of cans of crab meat.
Damn it, this is where one of those times in my life where I just feel like, why do I... Both of those things I kind of like.
But I could see Kelly at one point making some sort of crab dip and sitting there being like, I'm out of crab meat. I really need to go to the store. Meanwhile, Kenny's sitting there like knowing he has a whole cabinet of crab meat, but not telling her, just being like, yeah, maybe you should step out to the store or something. Yeah. While you're out there, give me a couple of mangoes, yeah.
Maybe some more crab meat.
Now, as far as the crime itself went, police also found a scarf belonging to Diane Wilder in Bianchi's apartment. And when police searched the murder scene, a single pubic hair belonging to Kim Bianchi was found on the stairs, conclusively linking him to the crime. Now,
they were really looking for pubic hair.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's what you got to do.
See, my house... They're everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you do seem like a puby dude.
I do what I gotta do. I maintain. I've learned to maintain.
Yeah, you're a hairy guy.
But they get rascally. And then the thing is that with between my back hair and my pubic hair, I don't know what hairs are what. The thing is that my back hair and my pubic hair are both gonna come out if I'm in a struggle.
Yeah, I feel like they connect sort of like a person wearing a onesie.
I now officially, this is probably inappropriate to say, but the hair now can grow from my beard to my chest hair and from my back hair to my head hair. I am legitimately, I have maybe 2 inches of body that are uncovered with hair.
You are becoming like Stephen King was in that horror short where he became a bush. I think it was a Dark Side or something.
See, I'm the exact opposite. I only have like 2 square inches of my body that actually has hair on it.
All right, so now that we've covered that.
Like a seal.
They found a pube, you say.
Now, there are a couple of different interpretations concerning the motivations behind the Bellingham murders. It could be that the motivation was just as simple as Ken not being able to keep his murderous impulses under control after 11 months of not killing. But another way of looking at it is that Ken may have committed the murders as a way to impress Angelo Bono or to prove to Bono, or to prove to himself that he could commit and get away with murder just fine without his cousin. When the police chief of Bellingham examined the bodies of the two young women, the Hillside Strangler murders were the first thing to pop into his mind. See, the chief was friends with the father of one of the victims of the Hillside Stranglers back in Los Angeles, so the guy was intimate with the details of the case. Mm. And so investigators, through interviews with Kelly Boyd, began digging into Ken's past. And not only had Ken lived at the Tamarind apartment buildings at the same time the call girl had been murdered there, Kelly also told him that because they didn't have a phone at their apartment, Ken often made and took all of his phone calls at the local public library where the call to lure the girl to the vacant apartment was made.
So I will say, I mean, I know it's 10 murders in, but it does seem like the cops are okay in this situation. They're actually trying to do some real detective work.
I mean, that we said that in the last episode, like the cops, both in Los Angeles and Bellingham, like they did a hell of a job. They did the best they could with what they had. And they worked across state lines. They worked across different jurisdictions. The cops actually did. This is one of those cases where the cops actually did do a pretty good job.
Yeah. Bono and Bianchi did a good job did a horrible job of covering up their tracks as well, but that's how good the police work was, is that they took all of these little pieces of information and kept them together. That's where a task force really works.
Yeah.
When you have like the walls of information, like you see in a true crime show nowadays, where you see like all the fucking yarn across different maps, that shit fucking just nabbed him real good.
We're not talking about the fucking hot dog squad here.
Right.
No.
Like, this is an actual like Los Angeles major metropolitan police department that actually knows what they're doing. Now, police also discovered that Ken had lived on Garfield Avenue, where two of the Strangler's victims were last seen. And after these revelations, cops searched the Bianchi house further and found a ring belonging to Yolanda Washington, which linked Ken conclusively to the Hillside Strangler murders as well.
Hmm.
And this right here doesn't have a whole lot to do with the case.
Mm-hmm.
But cops also found a pair of underpants and a towel that Ken had been masturbating into for months. They were both hardened and soaked from what was probably dozens, if not hundreds, of loads.
Wait a second. I know you're arresting me, and I know you're keeping me in the cell. I know you're investigating my home right now. Please tell me you didn't take my jerky cloths.
Yeah.
Did you take my jerky cloths? I've been working on those! You have any idea how hard it is to keep a shirt together for 9 months of shooting webs into it?
Unbelievable. I just feel bad for the detective who has to pick it up for the first time. What is this? Is this a bizarre stuffed squirrel? Oh, no!
Look at this incredible papier-mâché project that Bianchi was working on. Be like, what is that? It's kind of salty. It's like made with like kind of saltwater taffy that's like bleach flavored.
Oh, I know that smell. That smells like my husband. That spunk. Yeah, that spunk.
It's in my nose.
Yeah.
It's in my nose. It's in my eyelashes.
Oh, you're going to want to go to the doctor.
Yeah, you guys ever seen those pictures of like the cum boxers or the cum box? You know, on the internet, the guy that jerks off into his boxer shorts for like a year.
No.
And it's like got like a kind of a pool, but it's also like sort of fungusy a little bit.
Absolutely not.
Nope.
Never.
I'm with Henry on this one.
You guys, you want to?
Nope.
No. All right. Back. Can we just get to the subject at hand?
No. And even more bizarrely, they also found an old taxidermied rabbit that Ken had used as a sex toy of some kind on the regular.
Now, do you remember the story of the Velveteen Rabbit?
Yeah.
About how
what
he
wished it,
that he's like, they sometimes love can make you alive. In this case, I think that Velveteen Rabbit lived like one of Leonard Lake and Charles Ng's M girls.
So he used this with a woman?
No.
This was solo time.
This was Ken's alone time. This is like crab meat and his rabbit afternoon.
And all the phones.
He's eating crab meat, fucking a stuffed rabbit while his Kelly just moaning in the other room about how she's sick from being pregnant.
Wow.
Now, Kelly, speaking of Kelly.
Watching cricket on a black and white fucking television screen.
Yeah.
You can't interrupt a man's alone time. You can't judge a man's alone time.
You can't.
Speaking of Kelly.
I just,
she was so, what?
Nothing. I just picture him like sitting on a chair in a room, fake answering phones, looking at the stuffed rabbit, be like, "I'm coming for you." And then like remember,
it's better than him murdering girls.
Yeah.
If he just did that, we wouldn't have to do this podcast about him. That would be a secret shame that only he would know about.
It's more horrifying than Gacy's garage.
Now, Kelly, she was starting to realize that Ken was in jail for the long haul. So she brought up Ken's cancer. And he'd been keeping this whole cancer thing going. He was, I think, on like maybe year two of the cancer story. But cops soon discovered that there was no record whatsoever of Ken having any kind of cancer, even though he had brought report forms from the hospital to Kelly. Kelly brought these report forms to the cops. They're like, no, he has cancer. Look.
He has these forms. The forms say it. I mean, he's gaining weight, and I noticed him at the gym, and he did 50 pull-ups the other day, but these forms says he has it.
Must be true.
Yep. And what Ken had been doing is when he was in the hospital wandering around, he'd been stealing forms and forging his own name on the reports. And when Ken was questioned about this by Kelly, he said he had no memory of any of it.
Forms? What?
I'm just still very confused that he could walk around the hospital for 3 hours a day stealing forms and no one kicked him out.
Now, he only went in like once every couple weeks. You know, in hospitals, they got face blindness. They don't pay attention.
Yeah, everybody's a pre-corpse in a hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And he was Patch Adamsing it. He was walking around goofing around with the nurses, making the kids laugh. He had a fucking, they all thought he was like, laughter is the medicine that heals these children, and that doctor, if he even isn't a doctor, is a doctor of laughter.
All of his balloon animals just look like knives.
Then he stabbed the girl. Stab.
And the whole amnesia thing, that wasn't just the line that he gave to Kelly. When cops started questioning him about the murders in general, because they had ample evidence, both from Bellingham and Los Angeles, Ken, even faced with a mountain of evidence, denied remembering any of it actually happening. So, after being examined by a forensic psychiatrist, it was recommended that Ken undergo hypnosis.
What he did, though, is he did quickly lawyer up.
He
got arrested, he had a lawyer there all the time saying, don't speak, don't talk to these guys. Not, no doubt, don't speak. But
oh, I love that.
Lawyerly don't speak. It would be unprofessional for him to sing don't speak at a interrogation with a police officer.
Yeah, totally. I mean, unless, of course, he wanted to be let go immediately. great album, great song, Tragic Kingdom.
This is my defense attorney, Gwen Stefani. You could tell by her wonderful midriff and the troupe of Japanese girls she brought with her.
I'm still upset that Gavin Rosdale broke up with
About it.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Listen to page 7 for more. For more on Gavin Rosdale and Gwen Stefani and what is she doing with Blake Shelton.
What is she even doing
with
him?
I love Blake. Okay, don't even...
Go listen to page 7. GabeComedyRadio.com. Now, the first expert on hypnosis that they called in was Dr. John Watkins, the past president of the Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis and the past president of the Hypnosis Division of the American Psychological Association.
I can put anyone to sleep and they do anything that I want. I'm the Lord of Hypnosis.
That sounds terrifying.
You mean, man, a doctor walking around just being like,
you know, it's funny, you want the budget papers in on time? I can make you walk like a chicken anytime I like.
It'd be great in Vegas.
Now, the first session took place on March 21st, 1979. Watkins explained to Ken that he could use hypnosis to maybe fill in some of the gaps in his memory, and Ken was on board 110%.
Yeah, let's do it! Yeah!
And after a brief exploration of Ken's childhood, Dr. Watkins asked to speak to only a part of Ken rather than Ken as a whole. And Dr. Watkins referred to this part as Part, asking him, "Would you talk with me, Part?" by saying, "I'm here." So Ken slumped down and answered in a deeper, more surly voice, saying,
"I'm not Ken."
When the psychiatrist asked him who Ken was, he said,
"Well, you could call me Steve.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Now, Steve was a demonstrably different character than the mild-mannered Ken Bianchi. He was nasty, short-tempered, and aggressive, and had an extreme dislike for Ken, who he called...
An ass.
An ass?
He's like, oh, wow. he's an ass. He's soft.
Do you bite your thumb at me, sir?
He's an ass. You guys got any fucking go-gurt? I like yogurt I can squirt directly into my throat, unlike Ken, who can't handle a quart of fucking go-gurt. Ken, you pussy!
Wow.
But it wouldn't be long before Steve was confessing to as many Hillside Strangler murders as he could, implicating Angelo the whole way. With very little prompting did he start talking about these murders. Steve said,
Ken walked in on his cousin Angelo. Angelo had a girl over, and Ken walked in on the middle of Angelo killing this girl.
Now, who's Angelo?
Some turkey he knows. His cousin, somebody. It's somebody he knows. I don't know him. I'm Steve.
You're definitely the dumbest person I've ever put to sleep.
Hey, I'm Steve. Steven, please. Call me Steven.
Now, Steve went on to claim that it was at this point, when he walked in on Angelo murdering the girl, that he went from being just in the background of Ken's mind to taking over Ken completely, forcing him to commit murders, while the soft-hearted, wimpy Ken could only look on in horror. And when asked about the motivations for the murder, Steve said,
there was nothing wrong with killing, because it was like getting back at Ken's mother, you hear? Yeah!
Wow.
And he said that when he killed, it felt like he was killing his mother. And when asked why he hated women, Steve said,
they hurt.
That's it.
Okay, Steve is Ken. So Ken,
Steve is Ken.
I just don't understand.
He's putting on a fake voice and playing Steve.
Yeah, right, but Steve, it's just such a strange name to choose.
Steve.
Ken or Steve.
Well, we'll find out later why he chose the name Steve.
What does he want to name? And he's like, his name is Ravenstar.
That you could make up any name. And he went with Steve.
Now, listening to what Ken is talking about here, you might think that Ken not only had a high level of self-awareness, but also an understanding of serial murder long before such a thing was widely studied. But the truth of the matter is a combination of factors. First, Ken had a large collection of psychology books in his own personal library outlining the exact types of behavior that Ken was exhibiting.
Also, he wanted to be a cop for a long time, and he was training to be a cop, and he wanted to sound like he knew what he was talking about to cops, so that's because he would hang out with them all the time.
How big was this guy's house? He's got a phone room, a bizarre stuffed rabbit room.
In the 1970s, everyone was given a three-room house, just a three-bedroom house just off the top of their head. Yeah, that and the Do You Feel Like I Feel by, what's his name?
Frampton Comes Alive.
By Frampton Comes Alive.
Yeah. They issue it in the suburbs with Seasons of Tide.
Yes.
Yeah, that's Wayne's World.
Oh, that's it.
Kind of funny there, yeah.
Now, the other thing is that Ken's lawyer had compiled a report on Ken's childhood detailing all those incidents that we talked about in the first episode. And Ken, of course, had gotten his hands on that report prior to the hypnosis sessions. So Ken, pretty much, he had a full-on education in this stuff before he went in. And Frank Salerno, the original investigating detective in the Strangler case, was present at this first hypnosis session and wrote one word down in his notebook: bullshit.
Oh, that's unfair.
If you are a detective, though, you're a rational-minded person, specifically in this case, you have to watch this and just be livid.
They were.
I mean,
the whole time.
Well, Steve? Oh, now you're Steve? You fucking idiot?
Well, because this whole time he kept saying, I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember. They said the term that he was blowing smoke into the case, where he was saying this shit, and then when he came out as Steve, all of these cops were just sitting there because it's that classic thing of like, this man is badly faking a multiple personality disorder.
Right.
He is either a moron that needs to be hung in front of everyone, or this man man is even sicker and dumber than we even thought he was.
Is he too dumb for trial?
Yeah.
That's what they have to be concerned about now.
Yeah, but I mean, the cops saw right through it, but the psychiatrist, specifically Dr. Watkins, he was like, boom, multiple personality disorder.
Because that would make his career.
Exactly.
Like, he sees this story unfolding, he's just like, if I can just bring a proper multiple personality disorder into the fold, I will be seen as the genius as I am.
Yeah. Right.
Master of the mind.
He's like Dr. Loomis from Halloween.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And these guys were piggybacking on each other because that first guy, Dr. Watkins, he could say, I used hypnosis to bring this multiple personality out. And this next guy, Ralph Allison, his whole thing was, well, I can use this. He was a multiple personalities expert. Mm-hmm. And his whole thing was like, all right, well, I can use this as an example of how to break down ego states, because that's what he told Ken. When he came in, he was the second person. When they're like, all right, multiple personalities, let's bring in the multiple personality guy. And this guy, his name was Ralph Allison. He told Ken, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to allow you to speak to Steve. You and Steve can have a conversation with each other.
And this is just an incredible acting exercise. It sounds like fucking, like, yeah, he's in the actor studio.
Yeah. But the problem with that was that this doctor had to explain to Ken multiple personality disorder in detail. So he pretty much gave him an instruction booklet on how to fake multiple personality disorder. And with this, Ken had a clear path to an insanity plea.
I think we are overusing the term multiple personality disorder. There is nothing more generic than an average white dude. And now he's just going from Ken to Steve.
To Steve.
They're the same personality.
Yeah, it should. His name should be like,
he could have been Gowanna.
Yeah, he's like, ooh, child, you know I kill them girls because I hate them shoes.
Now we have a multiple personality. Right now I'm just seeing the same white dude with a different name.
I suffer from, in this context, I suffer from multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, what's your other name?
Thousands of other names. I hate me.
Well, that's what they'd said, is that they, like, Ken and Steve were caricatures.
Yeah.
They were caricatures of two different personalities. That Ken was the ultimate good and Steve was the ultimate evil. That it was too clean. It was way too clean. It was very, very clean. And the other problem with Ken doing the insanity plea, if Ken pled insanity and was found to be not guilty, police had no case against Angelo Bono whatsoever, as the only actual evidence they had that wasn't circumstantial was the testimony of Kim Bianchi.
Right.
And if Kim Bianchi was declared legally insane, his entire testimony would be inadmissible and Bono would go free.
Meanwhile, he's just standing around literally in front of his upholstery shop, flipping his coin with a pack of cigarettes rolled up in his sleeve. It's going like, yeah, he's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I've never done any of that. And all I do is sitting around here, yeah, I like the broads. But guess what? Broads like me. The brother.
Some of them did.
Now, regardless, Ken kept ratting out on his cousin. Further sessions revealed just how the two came up with this whole operation. And when asked how they decided to kill girls in the first place, Ken, as Steve, said,
sitting around, shooting shit. I asked them, hey, you ever kill anybody? He thought he was talking out of his ass. He didn't think anything of it. He said, I don't know. Why? Why do you want to know? And I said, well, I don't know. What does it feel like? And he said, well, I don't know. And I said, hey, you know what? We should find out sometime. And you know what he said? Okay.
Hey,
and we did it.
Steve.
Yeah, that's me. I'm Steve, not Kenny. Yeah.
This is kind of a funny game, honey. This is kind of a funny game I like to play with my multi-personality disorder clients. Steve, call Ken a jerk-off.
Kenny, you're a fat jerk-off.
It's actually him calling himself a fat jerk-off.
No, it's Kenny.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
Kennifer, I know how you hate that name. You blow yourself because you're afraid no one else will blow you.
I'm sorry, what?
No.
Steve, Ken blows himself?
No, that's something Steve shouldn't say out loud.
Oh, Ken, you're back.
Because he doesn't want to hurt Ken's feelings and spread the fact that Ken likes to fuck a stuffed rabbit in his craft meat room.
I think we've got what we needed.
But Steve knows what he's talking about.
So what did I say when I was, like, under? Oh, nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. In his notepad, look for cum stained rabbit.
The detective just writes bullshit again.
Now, this right here, this that we're about to play is an actual audio recording of Ken speaking as Steve about him and Angelo murdering women.
It's not as fun as my version.
No.
All right, let's go.
You want to know which ones? See, I got your case.
Okay.
You want to know which ones Angelo and I did away?
If you want
to
tell me.
You think I'm not going to tell you, huh?
I don't know if you're going to tell me or not.
Huh?
I don't know if you're going to tell me or not.
It's my decision, isn't it?
I guess it is.
Right.
You don't have to. You don't have to take credit for any of them. You don't want to.
Hey, man, it doesn't bother me any. I told you. Killing a broad doesn't make any difference to me.
Well, you want
killing
to
any fucking buddy doesn't make any difference.
Maybe you didn't kill any of those. I don't know.
Oh, hey, no, wrong, man. Hey, I killed a couple of these.
Well, which one? I mean, if you think you did, right? I don't know.
I killed her. Angelo killed her.
They mean the Wagner one Angelo killed.
This broad I'd never seen before.
Martin.
This broad I'd never seen before.
Hunchback, you never saw them at all?
No.
Oh.
This broad I'd never seen before.
Robinson? Yes.
This broad I killed. These two Wechter. Angelo killed.
Wechter. Johnson.
This one I'd never seen before.
Angelo killed, huh?
Now this one I'd never seen before. This broad I killed.
He does say that the taking of human...
I have to say they sound like two people who have been friends for 30 years solely because they sat together at a bar 30 years ago.
30 years
ago. Like Norman the Mailman from Cheers. They just sound like a bickering alcoholic duo.
So you're saying... So Kenny's the Frasier, and the police officer's the Norm?
Could be. Could be.
It is very interesting, again, the use of the term broad.
Yeah.
Everybody's just slinging around the term broad.
Yeah.
Over and over again, yeah. I mean, and it's almost like the psychiatrist has never seen a movie or anything, because, of course, the cops look at it like, that sounds so obviously fake.
He's doing a 1920s gangster voice.
Yeah.
While the other guy's just like, he's like, interesting. Like, writing it down, everything that he says.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, because all these guys are thinking about is their career. But right. Thankfully, the LAPD was not even close to being convinced. Because the name Steve might sound familiar to those of you who pay particularly close attention to part one of this series. Homicide detectives back in Los Angeles, thoroughly unimpressed with Ken's performance up in Bellingham, knew that an alias was usually based on the personal experience of the person using it.
Mm.
And the big break came when police discovered Steve Walker, the psychology student whose name Ken had stolen way back when he was trying to be an amateur psychologist in his pre-murder days.
It's like it's like in The Usual Suspects.
Yeah, Kaiser.
Yeah, Kaiser Soze, but in the dumbest way possible.
Yeah, he got dumber. He didn't get more intelligent.
Yes.
Yeah.
And armed with this fact, the sixth and final doctor Ken would see back in Bellingham was about to discover the truth. In May of 1979, Dr. Martin Orne, another well-known expert in hypnosis who testified at the Patty Hearst trial, discovered yet another personality hidden in Bianchi's brain, that of Billy, who is apparently the bridge between Ken and Steve.
They're just making it all up.
They are just making it all up.
Yeah,
that's what happened. That's what multiple personality disorder. There was like maybe five cases. They also said during this time, and while he was sitting in the holding jail, he ordered a copy of Sybil and he watched The Three Faces of Eve while in jail.
Huh.
He watched all this shit, read all these books, because in the 1970s, people were obsessed with multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, it was a huge thing. And, it led to the multiple personalities thing led to the Satanic Panic book the multiple personalities thing really became a huge phenomenon, and people wanted to believe it because it was a cool thing.
And also the vague sections of it sound like MKUltra training, which is real. And so then we have like the what is arcane conspiracy knowledge at the time that we'll find out later is real, as being sort of like snuck into all of this like pop culture psychology of like housewives, their personalities breaking apart and then cheating on their husbands.
Yeah. And these psychiatrists, like, since multiple personalities was like the hot thing at the time,
right,
if you got a multiple personality case, it was like striking gold.
You're gonna have
papers published, you're gonna have books published, you're gonna be brought on television shows. Like, it was a multiple personality was the path to the big time.
Right.
We're gonna get this stand-up pool and I'm gonna name it the Steve Walker Commemorative Pool.
All right. So Billy is the bridge between Ken and Steve.
Yeah.
And this
He's the bridge between the two.
And this is what he sounded like. I got a description of it from Serial Killers Up Close and Personal. He was a little boy. It was Kenny at the age of 9.
Mm-hmm.
Mommy was hitting me so bad, I met Stevie. I closed my eyes. I was crying so hard. All of a sudden, he was there. He said hi to me. He told me I was his friend. I felt really good that I had a friend that I could talk to.
It's kind of sad.
It's really sad. I mean, but
can you imagine a grown rapist murderer making the voice?
Yes.
And then it shifts from sad to very scary.
Yeah. Yes, right.
Yeah, to terrifying.
But also dumb.
Yeah. And then Billy eventually, because they started with age regression. And Billy started off as a little kid, and then eventually he got older and older because these two personalities were with him throughout his entire life.
He's also not good at voices. He's not a voice actor.
Yeah, he's really bad at it. See, Billy, he was the bridge. He was somewhere in between the two. Ken was the saint. He never did anything wrong. He was a loving father. He was a great employee, great friend. Steve was the sadistic asshole. He raped, he killed, and, you know, was just generally a pox on humanity. Billy was like, yeah, he was the one who lied. He was the one who cheated, but he's always like, you know what? I never really got on board with the killing.
Yeah,
Billy, I never really liked all the killing all that much.
He's the creepy puppet. That's what he sounds like.
But you know what's really interesting? They said a part of the reason why he came up with the multiple personality disorder in the first place was because his attorney was like, you need to find a way to make to exonerate yourself in a way.
Yeah.
And what he did was he sat him down and described the process of what it's like to be hung by the state of California. And he was like, some people go to the gallows screaming. They have to strap them down. And he's like, and if they screw up the hanging, you're paralyzed. And then you choke to death over 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Come up with something quick. We need a hit, kid. We need a hit. Sounds like a record producer, literally.
See, that's the thing, is that, you know, now that Billy was coming out, Dr. Oren, he was getting closer to the truth about Ken's so-called multiple personalities. Because the thing about multiple personalities is that if they even exist at all, because there is still to this day a lot of debate as to if multiple personality disorder is an actual thing, if they even exist at all, they're created as a means to deal with extreme stresses, usually sexual abuse in childhood, and that persona, the different personas that are created, they're there to defend the dominant psyche. In other words, it's not a voluntary act at all. It's all a stress-related switch. But Ken was able to switch from personality to personality at the behest of the hypnotist. And furthermore, Ken, Steve, and Billy, like I said earlier, they were just too clean. They were caricatures of good, evil, and somewhere in between. They weren't complex personalities at all. It's like you said, Ben, like it's just like three white guys. It's like one that is cool, one that's cool, one that sucks, and one that's a rapist murderer.
Right.
What about Daniel Day-Lewis and Lincoln?
Yeah, multi-personality.
Daniel Day-Lewis and my left foot. Daniel Day-Lewis and there will be blood.
Do you think he's a murderer?
No, he chose multiple personalities over money.
Oh, yes.
Money helped him choose to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the final nail in the multiple personality coffin came when Oren told Ken to hallucinate that his lawyer was in the room. Didn't prompt him, just told him, hey, your lawyer's in the room. That's it. And Bianchi, playing along, reached out to shake the imaginary lawyer's hand. The only problem with that is that while subjects under hypnosis can be made to hallucinate people and objects, they never physically interact with them.
Finally. Ooh. Somebody was just like, because you know, finally Oren just said to me, like, this is the worst case of fakery I have seen right. in a long time.
He actually was. He was like, this is, like, he kind of looked down on the rest of the psychiatrists like, what have you people been doing?
Because at this point, now Kenny's in there doing a three-ring fucking circus show. He's like Martin Short doing his, like, a Broadway show. They're coming in there. Like, more and more cops are building up. It's kind of like Henry Lee Lucas. It's the same thing. Because Kenny, Kennifer, got off from attention.
Yeah.
And so now, again, it's now shifted to here. Now I can have attention in this little arena.
Yeah.
And now I'm doing it. I'm playing all these people. And so finally, somebody with some level of reason showed up and was just like, it's just... this is insanity.
Yeah.
And a lot like Henry Lee Lucas, the Bellingham Police Department really took a shine to Kenny. He was allowed to get Sybil. He was allowed to watch movies and, you know, get books. He was allowed to correspond with anybody that he wanted to without any sort of supervision whatsoever. He was just going whole hog on everything.
I know from my father A cop will make instant friends with anyone who wants to listen to their stories.
Good point.
And that's how it goes. All you have to do is ask a cop, what's your worst story? And he's like, all right, here, you want to hold my gun?
And so 6 psychiatrists later. And by the way, I don't know if I'd stress that enough. 6
right.
psychiatrists examine this guy. Ken's story finally collapsed, and his insanity plea was rejected. And faced with a mountain of evidence and insanely detailed confessions, Ken had no choice but to plead guilty, and in a deal made with the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, he avoided the death penalty by testifying against Bono. And testify he did for 6 months, essentially being the biggest pain in the ass the Los Angeles criminal justice system would see until Charles Ng took the stand 2 decades later.
Wow.
Wow.
He was a showman after all.
He was.
He really was. And well, I guess he would switch from day to day. Like, until one day he would actually switch from hour to hour. And he would come in the morning and say, like, yeah, I killed all these women. Like, I did this, I did that. Angelo was there. And then he'd come in the afternoon and say, like, you know what? I forgot. I don't remember anymore.
It is sort of like going back to Family Matters when Stephen Urkel, when Urkel would turn into Stephen Urkel. I loved those episodes.
It is like
so
that,
if I was
right.
a juror, I would be like, oh, I hope Steve comes in today.
I
love it when Steve's there.
But I do imagine that Stefan Urkel, would murder a girl choke her with a plastic.
Yes. That was actually a stalker situation if you go back and watch that sitcom.
Dangerous.
Very dangerous what he was doing to Laura.
Steve Urkel is very similar to the Santa Barbara lady killer guy.
Steve Urkel or Stefan?
Steve Urkel.
I don't know. He seemed a lot more
Laura
good.
Laura is really lucky she didn't end up with a fucking bullet in her head.
Well, her father was a police officer as well.
Even worse, guns in the house.
Well, it's... Oh.
Well, one other interesting thing about Kim Bianchi's psyche, and as far as attention went, is that when he was in Bellingham and all of these cops and psychiatrists were fawning over him and giving him everything that he wanted, he was extremely cooperative. He actually, you know, he went and he, you know, confessed and he cried during the trial or during the hearing. But as soon as he went down to Los Angeles for Bono's trial, nobody gave a shit about him anymore. The LAPD, they didn't placate him. They didn't give him anything that he wanted, so he pretty much turned into a little titty baby and refused to cooperate, and that's why he spent 6 months on the witness stand.
What he also apparently did too, one statement he made is during it, is that when he got shipped down to LA, he's like, I finally get my dream of being a murder investigator. Like, he's got to, because he was investigating his own murder.
Right.
Like, his own murder, like, he got to play cop.
You know, well, I mean, one cool thing about investigating your own murder, you'll solve it. You know, like,
because all you have to
do
is spin around. Where's the killer? Where's the killer?
Nope.
Oh, it's me.
It's me.
Pointing at my nose.
Look at that. Got it. Nailed it.
And after the longest trial in California history at that time, Angelo Bono would be convicted and sentenced to life in prison, where he died in 2002. Bianchi is still alive and has since decided that he is innocent of all charges, and to this day vows to one day find, quote unquote, the real killer.
OJ. OJ did it.
I love that. I love the vow to find the real killer.
Oh, yeah.
Always. Yeah, of course, because that is how he would exonerate him. Or that's how he would be exonerated. And there's also a weird epilogue to this story involving a woman named Veronica that I think we're going to get into in a future episode, Women Who Love Men Who Kill.
She saved his life. That's what she said, because she also brought him the love of Jesus Christ.
The love of Jesus Christ. Good. That's after she left him for the Sunset Strip strength.
Well, but she's got a type.
Yeah, we'll get. Oh, that woman has a type. But yeah, we'll get into her possibly in a future episode. We don't want to give that one away just yet, but it's a really
mustaches.
Weird, yeah, loves the mustache.
All
and
right.
That's it. That's the Hillside Stranglers.
All right. Hillside Stranglers. Another great job of research, Mr. Parks.
Thank
wonderful
you very much.
Stuff. Very
Henry
educational.
Henry did a hell of a lot on this one as well.
Great
and
work,
also,
Henry.
Thanks to April Bennett, research assistant April Bennett, who really helped out a lot on this one as well.
Our first two research assistants unfortunately died in the process of the Om Shinrikyo episode.
Oh, so unfortunately.
This is in memoriam of them, this episode.
Yeah.
Yes. It's one of those things where I love the big hitters. I love doing these big hitters. I love researching them. Sometimes I'd be like, I wish they hadn't done this.
Yeah. Oh yeah, always wish we didn't even have a show. I would prefer if this doesn't even exist. Yeah,
what would we do if we didn't have all of that, though?
Aliens. It would be aliens and ghosts and big feet and all sorts of other fun stuff.
I would love to talk about Sasquatch and random cryptids.
And we're gonna. Yeah, we've got our next couple episodes are gonna be real fun.
Guys, check out on Netflix. It was a straight to DVD set that you could only get from the back of a magazine. I remember because I had a copy for MUFON magazine from when I was a child, and I always wanted the set, but my mom was just like, "You're disgusting. No, you can't have an alien book. You already have too many books with Satan's on the covers, and you're gonna go talk to the priest." Well, the priest is just lubing up his hands for the other boys. It's called UFOs Best Evidence Caught on Tape.
I watched it
on Netflix, and it rules. Yeah.
Well, one of them is a helicopter.
Well, there is literally one where it is a helicopter.
You can see the spinners.
Your promise?
What do you call them?
You're thinking about it. You just gotta stop thinking about it.
No, it was very funny. I actually watched that. Great series.
Yeah, and we've got to make a couple of thank yous right now. We've got to say thank you to Brianna Parrish for sending us this amazing John Wayne Gacy illustration.
Oh my god, it's so good.
It's cute. It's real cute.
It's super cute.
It's adorable. You can find I checked out her stuff. She's an amazing illustrator. You can check her out at briannaparrish.com. That's two N's.
You know what's so
R's.
Weird? It's so bizarre. I didn't even see that as John Wayne Gacy. I thought it was of you, Henry. I just thought I didn't even
it is very interesting, right?
Yeah.
No, we're blending together. Yeah. Who made this picture?
That would be Aaron Towns. Did a real cool picture and a set of playing cards of us as two real houses for feet and dog meat.
That's
and he drew
so cool.
Me wearing a really cool little David Bowie low t-shirt.
It is really cool.
It is really cool.
It is really cool.
Really funny. Gave
it's
me
really
doggy
cute.
Ears and a doggy nose.
I like to make a couple shout-outs. I like to make a shout-out to Stevie Chris, who shot all these photos for us that we've been using as promo material for Last Podcast on the Left. I like to thank my girlfriend Natalie because she put a lot of work into that too, and it's fucking worthwhile. They both kicked ass.
Yeah,
they've been helping us a lot. It's really awesome. I want to give a shout out to Lord Rael, man. How's the weight going, you fucking fat piece of shit?
Okay, leave him alone. He's got a thing going.
You still sweating your balls off of Baja, Mexico, you idiot?
I kind of got a lot of respect for him.
This is my question, Lord Rael. If you're in the Facebook group, fucking show yourself so we can pants you on the internet, you dumb shit.
I'm a follower. I think he's got a lot of great points.
I also want to get a shout out to Baron Corbin, a.k.a. The Big Breakfast.
Yeah.
You may actually know him better as the Lone Wolf on WWE.
Links, all the hash browns. You know he's going to shove your face deep down into a pile of scrambled eggs.
Oh, God. Now I'm getting aroused. We got to end the episode soon.
And, of course, thank you, everybody, for giving to our Patreon. You can go give to our Patreon, patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft. Any amount that you give is totally cool with us. Thank you so much. Every tiny little bit counts, and it helps. And it helps us to bring us to live shows literally all around the world now. Our next live show that we have is in Atlanta on 16th. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we've got Washington, D.C. The following Saturday.
At the Kennedy Center.
The Kennedy Center.
Well, man, I'm going to steal so much shit from Adam Carolla's dressing room.
Oh, can't wait. But it is June 16th. July 16th, we'll be in Los Angeles.
We've got a
busy couple of months.
June 18th. Jesus Christ.
You know what? Ladies and gentlemen, Google it, okay? We don't have to know. We'll be there.
You can just Google it, all right?
I promise you, when the show happens, we will be on that stage no matter what day
we'll
it is.
And also, we're forced to be.
And also, by the way, our live show this month, our New York live show, is going to be on July 2nd. It's not going to be the fourth Saturday. It's going to be the first Saturday of July. And then in July, we're coming to Los Angeles. And then in August, we're coming back to Baltimore.
You know what? We have them so confused at this point.
No, I know. I got it in my head.
Can we start the standard? We'll see you when we see you.
We'll see you when.
And in October, don't forget. In October, we just added a couple of shows to our UK tour. We're doing Glasgow. Glasgow. Yeah, Glasgow. Yeah, we're doing that.
We're going to do great in Scotland.
This is going to be exciting.
Tickets are on sale for that, gigsandtours.com. We also added a second Thursday London show. So, guys, come on out and fucking see us there. And we're working on a couple of other European dates It's going to be so fucking cool.
Toss a couple of shrimps on the Barbie London.
It's not the right country.
Take your trolleys and your ruse everywhere.
Different
I hope a dingo doesn't eat our baby out there.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be exciting. Thanks for supporting all the shows here at CCR. Abe Lincoln's Top Hat for Politics, Roundtable of Gentlemen, the Lucky Bone Show for your music needs, and Page 7 and Sex and Other Human Activities if you want to hear Marcus discuss sex and other human activities.
Yeah.
Like shitting.
Yeah. That's the only other one, right? It's sex? Yeah.
No, mental health.
Oh, okay.
We talk about mental health.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, it's just
and
doing...
And my daily struggles.
All right, the struggle is real.
No. The struggle is mine, my friend.
Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gein.
Hail me.
Legos Delations, one and all.
To each and every one of you sad asses.
For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to cavecomedyradio.com.